In this episode of The Ownership Economy, we sit down with Amber Case of the PlurigRid Project. In the conversation, we talk about the intersection of open source software economic models, cybernetics, anthropology, and how combining the three can open up new possibilities in distributed energy resources management and distributed resilient microgrids. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Thanks for joining us today, Amber.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
So we like to kick things off pretty simply just by getting to know you more as a person. So what's the story of Amber Case? You can start wherever you like. You can start at 6 years old, earliest memory, whatever you like.
Sure. So my story is that I grew up in Denver, Colorado. Both my parents were broadcast engineers, which means that this was in the 80s, the mid 80s and 90s. So they were on the cusp of a transition in the television industry where it was going from analog to digital. And so my mom was a master control operator, which meant that she hand spliced in all of the reels, reel-to-reel television, spliced in the commercials, ran them online. It kind of looked like, you know, that scene in The Matrix where you have all the television screens, like,
yeah,
that, but analog. So it was the highest paid position at the TV station. Both my parents did this very blue-collar work task. It was really fun working at the station. Of course, when they came home, they didn't want to watch TV because that was their job.
So, that's amazing.
We had this little television, you know, in the bedroom. And what we did watch on that was Star Trek Next Generation, starting in 1987. So I remember some of my earliest memories are watching Star Trek. And that totally made my worldview. I was an only child. My parents' friends were from all over the world. So we had friends from Japan, from China, from Nigeria, and from Lebanon. I did not encounter a lot of Americans. The people on my block were like kind of these really brutal Americans. They were just like really racist. They were really intense. I was kind of afraid to go outside, and I was the hugest nerd. So by the time I went to school, I was definitely getting made fun of, one, for not understanding American pop culture because I didn't really experience it, and two, for not having any like American slang. Because I was eating and eating food from other countries. I grew up on Japanese food and Lebanese food.
No. So it was. You are just, I fear that you are foretelling the future of my son. We live in Spain. He doesn't even know what American football is. You know, English is his first language. He has an American accent, but he has literally no idea.
That's great. I mean, it's kind of interesting because, you know, when I watched Star Trek, it wasn't a big deal. Everybody came from another country. They still had their accent. They're on the bridge. They still had their same rituals and routines that they carried over, yet they harmonized, right? The understanding was that the differences were beneficial to the bridge and to the crew, and they were practicing diplomacy and going out and exploring. And every single episode, there was some sort of kind of really intense issue that they had to all get through. And I thought that was the real world. I thought that we were, you know, kind of post-state. We were hanging out with each other. And we were solving problems together on this ship and exploring things, you know, that we'd gotten through all of the weird issues. I was very wrong. So another thing that happened is when I was a kid, my parents did not talk to me like a kid. They just talked to me like a mini adult, which was kind of stressful. My dad waited until I had hand-eye coordination. And the minute I did, he had me soldering components for him for synthesizers he was building and like little computers he was building.
Nice.
Right, all the resistor bands so that I could hand them to him, and it had to be done very quickly. So I was just sitting there, you know, in his lab, which is a super tiny house in Denver, you know, and, you know, I had a computer that I grew up with, like an Atari, and I was hand soldering all these components for him. And then I had to go to preschool. And I remember just being really sad, you know, going to preschool for the first time. All the kids had on like clothes that were like hypersaturated with logos. I was super confused. I just wanted to be home soldering with my dad, building rockets, whatever we were doing. So I did not, you know, I think the other thing that really changed my brain was I grew up in the 80s with the 1960 World Book Encyclopedia. So I was sitting there reading this encyclopedia that was out of date by 25, 30 years.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at what changed and what didn't change. And this was really important to me. It was, you know, okay, here's a forest. This forest hasn't changed that much. Oh, but here's the entry for computer. And the computer was like a PDP-8 or PDP-11, you know, in a college, right? Like what my grandpa worked on. And then I looked at our Atari and I said, what happened? The tree didn't change. This yeah. changed. What does that mean? And so I talked to my dad about that and he said, yeah, this stuff changes. And I said, well, what the heck? Like, why is this happening? And so that to me was a really big insight that technology is this unstable shape that's changing super rapidly. And then over time, my parents' jobs, this was one of the first waves of blue collar automation in the television industry. My mom's job was automated when I was around 10. She tried to go back to work to a place called DirecTV, and her job had been automated, consolidated, and then she was watching basically a computer do her job. And then my dad's job after that was to automate the stations. And I remember one of his last jobs before he died was there was a TV station that was, you know, tons and tons of channels consolidated, and the electronic equipment was so expensive and valuable that if there was a fire, to extinguish the fire, they just suck all the air out of the room and he'd have 30 seconds to get like out the airlock. And so I kept I kept having these nightmares that like he would, you know, that we'd find him dead, like crawling towards the airlock because there was some sort of stupid fire. You know, it was weird. And I was not having the experience of all the other kids in class. And so there was a lot of behavior issues because I was really into math and science. I was really into reading encyclopedias. I was really into hanging out with my friends from other countries. And so I ended up going to 10 different schools before I went to college just because of behavioral issues. I mean, it became semi-dangerous for me to go to school. I ended up becoming slightly tough. But my parents, you know, they wanted to make sure I had a good educational environment. And it was kind of a mess. So by the time I went to high school, you know, how I got into engineering was, you know, they took a bunch of us into a room and they gave us a bunch of math tests, and I was already, you know, doing super well, you know, from like first, second grade. I was already operating at like a high school level, I wanted to just get a GED and go to college. Like, this was a huge deal for me. My parents were like, no, we don't want you to be an egghead. So we're going to restrict you. You need to learn how to get along with people.
Yeah.
That was really hard for me because I just wanted to go fast, right? So they gave us all some tests, you know, I did really well on the tests. They were super easy. And then they said, if you did well on the tests, you get access to this program. And this program is called Project Lead the Way, sponsored by Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin had funded this basically inner city, super low rated school in Denver, put in some air conditioning, put in state of the art computers, 3D printers and all that stuff, like 2001, 2002. And I said, wow, cool, air conditioning. I want that. Here, let me just do this test really fast, you know. So I ended up taking all of these engineering classes where they were, you know, teaching us trigonometry in a day, you know, West Point Bridge Design Program. And they're all super competitive, as in you were in competition with the rest of the kids in your class. I definitely was the only girl in most of the classes. I took architecture, I took wood shop, I took mechanical engineering, I took CAD, you know. And so within 2 years, you know, I could use Autodesk Inventor, 3D printers, do G-code, like all this neat assembly stuff.
Well, actually, I wanted to interject here a little bit because you brought up a really interesting point with what your parents said when they were like, hey, we don't want you to be an egghead. You kind of had this windy path, you know, or you started, like you said, on your dad's lap, soldering from an early age. I didn't start that early. I was about seven or eight when my dad took me, and he was also a technician in building automation. So like actual like photolithography and all that kind of stuff, the machines that built that, that's what he used to do. But so what was interesting about you is you took this turn that I didn't take for probably another 20 years, which was that you really got into, your parents came like, we can't just have you be a one-dimensional egghead. And then you took this turn into anthropology, right? So actually, that's a really interesting turn that I like to dig into a little bit. How did that happen?
That is great. That's exactly what I'm going to talk about next. So I was into engineering. And then at the end of the engineering program, even halfway through, we went on a field trip. And the field trip was to Lockheed Martin. We got to hang out on the floor with the missiles and hang out, see the clean room. They took our whole class and they said, you know, after going through this program, if you get good grades, you all have jobs at Lockheed Martin. You don't need to go to college. Now, this was a program deliberately aimed at low-income youth. I was considered an at-risk low-income youth. And they wanted to kind of bootstrap. Here's all these people that we can train up. They're going to be really loyal to Lockheed Martin. the information that they gave us was really incredible. And I said, oh my gosh, I have a job. Yes, right? I was reading, you know, Heinlein, Asimov, you know, Richard Feynman's lectures on physics. My math teacher gave me a ton of books on math. I was, you know, doing all this work. So I was like, heck yeah, I definitely want to work for this. You know, they're getting me out of the swamp or wherever I was. And so I was deliberately prepared to do that, not do anything else, be very single-minded about math and science, you know? And I was looking into going to, you know, Caltech, MIT, any of these places. I think the Navy came to the school one day and they're like, who knows about nuclear reactors? And I was like, me. And they're like, you can go to MIT for free. And we'll, you know, you could work on a submarine and then you can retire at 35. And I was like, great, you know, I'm in. My dad lost his job during the dot-com boom or bust. And the only job he could find was in Cheyenne, Wyoming, at a little place called EchoStar. So it's a satellite uplink company. They put television on the air, multiple channels. And so we moved in the middle of high school from this like low income, restricted school. It definitely where I was always the minority growing up as a kid, you know, like as a white person in a bunch of different cultures. We moved up to Cheyenne, Wyoming. It was the first time I'd been in a class of a bunch of white kids. I was super confused. Everybody was very Christian. And it was very well funded. And we lived two blocks away from F.E. Warren Air Force Base. So definitely got an incredible education up there. But by the time I got out, I kind of burnt myself out. I worked at a computer repair shop trying to figure out what to do. And then I was trying to figure out how to go to school. And I asked my mom's best friend. All my mom's friends were mathematicians. My grandpa was a mathematician. There's just so many math people. I called her up on the phone and I said, hey, you know, I could work at Lockheed Martin. I'm all good. You know, I should go into math. I should go into engineering. And she said, nah, you should learn how to think. You should go to a private liberal arts college and do the thing that's hardest for you. What was the subject you got the worst grades in? I was like, social studies.
Oh, okay.
And she said, great. You know, here's a list of private liberal arts colleges. You know, I live in Minnesota. Maybe go to one here or, you know. So I looked and I got myself, you know, almost a full ride to Lewis and Clark College up in Portland, Oregon. I literally took a Greyhound bus to get there for the first time.
You know? Nice.
It was like a 24-hour trip. And I showed up middle of the year, actually like December. Didn't have any of the orientation. You know, I literally called admissions. I said, look, I have like an Ivy League application. Can you give me a bunch of money to go to school? My parents definitely can't pay for this. I can't take on loans. I didn't know you could take on loans. I was like, I can't take on any loans. And I show up and I take just like liberal arts and history classes, communication class, you know, where we had to give speeches. I took a class called Inventing America. I took sociology, anthropology. I declared my major within 5 days that I was going to do sociology, anthropology. And then I had to get out in 3.5 years due to funding. So I needed to like consolidate. So I was doing 21, 22 credit hours, sometimes 24 credit hours a semester, full load of summer classes, got rid of all the restrictions to do math and science and foreign language, didn't do the semester abroad. And I just ingested, you know, like English history, you know, colonization, anthropology. And the very end of the first semester, I was just running around campus trying to find free food. You know, my meal plan kind of had enough food, not totally enough food.
I remember these days.
Yeah, I was just, you know, I was like this feral dog trying to find table scraps. And there was this thing called a philosophy colloquium. And they said, you know, so I show up and they said, well, we got food at the end. So I have to sit through this whole thing.
Nice. I think I see where this is going.
Yeah, sitting through it. At the very end, there is this very interesting woman. Or actually, at the end, there's this very interesting person with like short kind of reddish hair that looks kind of like a motorcycle babe or something. It's like wearing like leather. Shows up at the end. And they're a professor of anthropology, and they give a lecture on cyborg anthropology. And so,
don't tell me this was Donna Haraway.
This is not Donna Haraway.
Okay, I was like, because I don't remember having red hair. I was like, holy shit. Okay, wow.
This was whenever he helped midwife the field of cyborg anthropology into being
amazing.
So, they were this great human, and I immediately was like, whoa, look at the aesthetics of this person. Like, just think about the aesthetics of the, you know, phrase cyborg anthropology. What does that mean? Holy crap. I had to stay till the end. And Deborah talked about that. The minute I heard the phrase, I said, that's what I want to do. I want to marry the two. where, you know, you have cyborgs, you have anthropology. This could be a way to understand how systems and technologies work in the world. I have to take this class. Can I major in this? I asked them at the end. I said, can I do this? They said, well, you've got to take this class first. It's only offered every other year. So I worked with them to allow myself to take quantitative research, and I think qualitative research, and the thesis class at the same time. Early, got my thesis done a semester early, and just, I had to do it. So I just pulled out, you know, try to manipulate the bureaucracy as much as possible to get myself into this freaking class. And then it was super complicated. The class was all about these different subjects, you know, biology, technology, anthropology, policy. Like, there's too many things, you know, it was at the intersection. Reading the Cyborg Manifesto for the first time was confusing.
I'm glad to hear I'm not alone on that. I've read it like 3 or 4 times, right? Like, I don't say I'm still, I'd say I'm definitely still confused about parts of it, but yeah, I definitely agree.
Yeah. I mean, my read on the Cyborg Manifesto, which is an essay published in the Socialist Review of Feminism, is that it's an Onion article. It's a prank. The whole thing is a prank. If you read it as a prank, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I've heard that before too. Yes, agree.
So the prank is that, you know, you take a military industrial complex word like cyborg, which comes from space travel. The definition is any organism through which exogenous components are added for the purpose of adapting to new ambient spaces, which pretty much means somebody in a spacesuit puts on a spacesuit, they can self-regulate in a space they're not meant to be, and they can kind of harmonize with their environment internally. Cool, DAOs, right? And so this becomes really important to think about self-regulating systems, you know, cybernetics. And, you know, I didn't totally get, I learned about the Macy meetings from the 1940s where technologists and anthropologists got together to talk about the future of humans. But cybernetics was not really, it wasn't really a total understanding at that point. Things were still fairly hazy. And then I remember all of my colleagues, all of the college students that I was going to school with, you know, most of them had trust funds. And so they were flying all over the world doing their thesis research or going to Burning Man and like spending a lot of money on a camp and then using that for the research excuse. And I talked to my professor and I said, hey, I don't have money to go around and do all this expensive research. What can I study in my immediate environment that doesn't require me to travel, that's in line with cyborg anthropology? And she said, you know, why don't you study cell phones? They're in everybody's pockets. So I was one of the first people ever to do research on the iPhone when it came out in 2007. I wrote my thesis on it. How the flat screen of the
iPhone,
yeah, how that would change, you know, everything.
Did the title user experience researcher even exist back then? I don't remember. I know user experience designer fares right around that time. I don't know if UX researcher was around. So you may have been the first one.
That was, yeah, it was emergent. You know, there's a whole history of like how that term came to be and what that means. At that point, it was, you know, there's human factors engineering, there's kind of the Carnegie program. It was very, you know, you need a master's degree. So yeah, this was a whole thing that happened. And then that writing that thesis, you know, that winter was intense because I started to see what the future could be. A little bit before, it felt very similar to reading that 1960 World Book Encyclopedia and making bets with my dad on Sunday morning, you know, what the price of a terabyte would be, you know, in 2010, you know, or my dad and I had lots of bets on things.
By the way, do you remember any of those? Just, I'm curious now that you sent that, what did you bet on the price of a terabyte and what did it turn out to be? Because you couldn't foresee the cloud making terabytes available on demand, right? But the price would be interesting.
Yeah. So my dad and I had a competition. There was resource constraints in our family, but if I wanted an allowance, then, you know, I would need to do some labor. And the labor would be, you know, I want this hard drive. I want this graphics card. I want this, you know, weird heat sink. I want thermal paste. I want whatever, because I'm building my own computers and stuff like that. If I get the price right in the future, my dad will buy me the hard drive. My dad will buy me the RAM stick, right?
That's
now,
awesome.
If I don't get it right, I don't get it. So my incentive model was extreme to be able to predict these within the dollar, you know?
This is a good exercise too, because I feel like it's almost like a prep for some of these, you know, like dumb management consulting interviews, right? What is the tell us what the price of, you know, a photolithography machine in 2023 will be, right? And it's like, exactly. And you have to be like, let me work back from, well, how do I do? I do logistics, supply chain, where do I, it's very interesting, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, you can't predict too much into the future. Things get really wonky because you have to say, like, there's political, economic, social things. If you don't understand political, economic, and social, you obviously are not going to be able to make a really good assessment of what the price is going to be. You just can't, right? Because there's more than that, right? So yes, this all kind of harkened back to that. I was starting to understand my time delay. I feel like everybody has a time delay when they're like an inventor. My dad was an inventor and was always building like microphones, speakers, all these things. And my grandpa was an inventor too. And then everybody else in the family all the way back, you know, worked on railroads because that's what you do if you're a nerd engineer. So it was just, you know, something you had to do, right? Like you had to figure out your time delay or you would die, right? Because how do you get funding for something if you don't, if you're too early, it's bad because there's not enough R&D budget. You know, you haven't gone through the loop of figuring out the market. If you're late, it's better because you can see all the moves that everybody has played. And you can do analysis of those plays, and then you can just do the thing that everybody ran out of funding before they were able to understand. Basically, you read the last chapter of everybody's book, and you layer them all on top of each other, and then you solve for that. It's kind of like geospatial analysis, but with, like, you know, information.
Or even, like, the fossil record or something, right? And like, going through every layer of it. The origins are, this is where they died. This is where they died. Where, what does it say? Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Right.
So, you know, and I think this would be good to, you know, kind of talk about the startup that I was working at the time in college.
Oh yeah, that was my next question, actually, like, because then you, you went from, I'm, you know, a doer, I'm only engineering and math matters. And then you get into like, well, humans, this is really interesting. Let me study them. And then you're like, wait, I'm going to make a company now. Fill us in. How, like, what was that first sort of jump in the startup land?
Sure. So it's really important to kind of understand my mental state. I was not popular in college. I eventually moved to the international dorm where I got along really well with all the TCKs. TCK stands for third culture kid. It's the weirdest assessment ever. It means that you've grown up in one country and you move to another one and then you're in another one. So you know at least three languages. You've had to move around a lot. Maybe your parents are diplomats or royal cartographers or whatever. So I moved there and that was a lot better. And really the whole story of EverCharge, which is a startup that allows you to charge your car in your apartment or condo, was, again, I was hungry running around campus. I really wanted to learn how to make this Japanese dish that I just couldn't make called okonomiyaki. It's Japanese pizza. You basically put the ingredients on the plate. You put the ingredients in, you put batter over it, you flip it upside down. It tastes really good. I had been trying to make it. I failed. But then I saw a flyer. There's okonomiyaki making at the international dorm. I ran over, learned how to make okonomiyaki. Hooray. But to the side of this meetup, there are these people named Mario and Adon. Mario's parents were artists, painters in San Francisco. Adon went to a technical high school, had done all this innovation, made his first startup at like 13, was going to college in cash, super smart. And they were kind of whispering over that they had an electric car club. And, you know, it's like that little voice inside of you. Or for me, I was like, I went over and I said, I went to the wrong college. I really want to do a startup. You guys are like, you have this club. Basically, every alarm bell in my head rang out and said, go over there. You need to join this project. You don't know anything about electric cars. You have to be there. It doesn't matter. Just go. And I was like, hey, I want to be friends. I want to join the electric car club. And they're like, okay. And so that's how it started. We had like five people in this club. And, you know, we were working on all renewable energy. That was literally our tagline. It was called Green It. Go greenit.com. All renewable energy. Didn't know what that meant, right? Like, had no idea. So, you know, how did this work? Well, we ended up going to the president's office of the school. And what we learned is that the business program at the school had been removed in favor of liberal arts education. And we needed to get a meeting with the president because we wanted to go and pitch some VCs.
And this was your first dalliance with our ilk, was it?
Yeah, definitely. And we needed funding to have a C corporation. And we needed a flight down to San Francisco. And so we couldn't get a meeting with the president, but then we basically made electric car shaped cookies for the president's three secretaries, gave the cookies to the secretaries. They got us a meeting with the president very quickly.
Are you kidding me? All it takes is cook for the.
You gotta get in somehow. You gotta get in somehow. So
it's so cheap. That's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, well, you just gotta care about the people who are managing the person's time. And we all talked with them and we got to be friends with them. And we're not treating them as a pass through entity. Admins are very important. There's somebody.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
So if you treat them as they are, you know, the exocortex of these people, and, you know, most times just as smart as them at that level, you know, super seasoned people, then, you know, of course they're going to open the door for you. So we show up to the president and we say, hey, we know that the business program is gone, but what if we did a startup when we did well? Wouldn't that return, you know, millions of dollars to you in terms of like interested students that are going to go to Lewis and Clark instead of Stanford? And he was like, huh, when you put it that way, you know, and so we said, look, we just need a flight down to San Francisco hotel. And we have already gotten Young Inventors International to pay for the price to enter the Dow Jones Emerging Ventures Forum conference.
Nice. In 2006,
which was a $25,000 pay to play VC pitch thing. So you don't need to pay that. But then the college invested in our startup. They paid the incorporation fee with their lawyers, of course. It turned out to be like 30K, you know. Yeah, yeah. I mean, right. And then what happened was that my first time going to San Francisco, right? I'd never been there before. First time staying in a fancy hotel. First time, like, you know, being on this flight. Mario has got super long hair, you know, we're all kind of big stoners. I borrow my friend from Singapore's like business suit, which is like a size 2. I barely fit in this thing. And we go, and we're young inventors. We're 19. Young Inventors International funded two other teams that are like 27. That's what they mean by young inventors. They don't mean 19-year-olds.
Oh.
Like 27-year-olds. Postdocs from MIT making inhalable vaccines, making bomb tracking technology that, you know, have a decent amount of revenue, not people with a page that says green it. I'll renew that.
Well, I think you were definitely ahead of the curve, because that's like 2011 era startups right there, right? That's like your accelerator. Like, hey, we have an interest form on a landing page and we have 15,000 people who want to try this thing, right? you were ahead of the curve.
Yeah. So yeah, Mario and I went down there and I remember walking in this was my first conference too. You know, this got me in the conference kick, speaking at conferences, you know, traveling around the world, meeting people. The very first person that Mario saw was Vinod Khosla, who walked right up to Vinod and said, hi, we're doing all renewable energy. We're doing electric cars.
And he's like, sorry, I can't do it. I just invested in some company called Tesla.
Solar City around that time, right? So
yeah, yeah.
Which then, you know, joined Tesla, right? So I was like, how do you do that? You just walk up. He's like, you know, he's like, I went to an acting high school. You just, you know, you just walk and talk to people. I was like, that's Vinod Khosla. Ah, you know, and Vinod just was so stunned that he just kind of talked with us for a while. And it was super obvious by the end that, you know, we had nothing investable. We didn't have a product. We didn't have any idea what we're doing. And I was humiliated. And Mario was like, do, 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 do. I was like, I was just so upset that how dare we waste people's time without having a plan, you know? And I get serious about this sometimes, like, ah. And so basically what happened was, you know, Mario pitched on stage. People were kind of trying to help us out. I got, you know, pretty upset. And, you know, I don't know if you should include this or not, but I brought some tabs of acid. And afterwards, I had Mario and I take the acid. We walked through the mission. And I said, we don't have a product. This isn't real. The only way to get you to listen to me is to have you take this acid. You have to understand what's happening, you know. And then by the end of that, he was fairly upset. Maybe we can't include that. I don't know. I don't have permission from Mario about that. So maybe we don't include that.
Strategy, right? I mean, every single founder that I know that he's gone out with, it always starts with 2CP or something. So
yeah.
And now we're you have to cut all this. You can't reveal the trade secrets, man.
No, I think I'm gonna tell the story a little bit different.
Yeah.
We were walking through the mission. I finally got to Mario, telling him that we didn't really have anything. Got pretty depressed, but then things kind of started to change. And we went to the next conference in 2007. We had something a little bit more. But along the way, we were talking with the general counsel of Lewis and Clark. And they were like, you know, you don't have to make an electric car. We actually made one. We actually got a car, converted it to electric in a garage, and then we sold it to somebody because we looked at the R&D for making an electric car, and it was like, you know, $1 million just for safety testing. And we're like, the amount of money that we would need to have to make a car is that in order to make electric car, you need to go luxury first so that people can sponsor your R&D and your supply chain process. It's much cheaper to make a luxury car than it is to make a cheap car. And then you can go down and down and down into an economy car, but you have to start expensive. So
right.
We looked at that. We said, there's no way we're going to raise that much money. We're not in that position. Also, there's too many details. So then we looked at what can we do instead? We could do inductive road charging, which we also made the prototype of. So you could drive over and it just inductively charge in the road. I was looking through that and said, how do you maintain that when it's snowing outside? You know, like, this is a lot of infrastructure you'd have to build. Then we looked at electric vehicle charging. And we also looked at just the billing and charging system. Because the guy at Lewis and Clark was like, you know, there's a startup in just that credit card acceptance model at the gas station pump. And if you got that and patented that for electric vehicles, you'd do pretty well. And I said, wow, like, this is my first time just being like, pick apart the entire business model, take a really small slice, and then just work on that. So that was super exciting. I was like, okay. So because I had all this CAD experience from Autodesk and all this stuff, I was able to model out and draft up a bunch of diagrams. And then my dad has like 60 patents because he's an inventor. So I learned how to do patent research and diagrams. And so I ended up just starting to draw out all these patents super fast, right? And they've become some of the early bigger patents in the electric vehicle charging space, right? So it was like, how do you do charging when there's multiple cars in a parking garage or, that want to charge, right? How do you run that through? Eventually, our market was, this is the brilliant thing that Mario did. He understood that there's a bunch of subsidies, government subsidies for electric vehicle charging stations, as long right. as they were in like a parking lot of like a supermarket. So he changed his major to like economics. Adon changed his major to communication. So we all had like a much better understanding of what we would need to do this startup. And so through Mario's thesis, he was doing like, you know, electric car thesis. He noticed that if you have a government subsidy that's too much, you're going to make a really expensive charging station. You're going to make something that costs millions of dollars. You're going to charge. You're going to just run through that grant money as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And you're going to make inefficient systems. And where do people charge their electric vehicles, right? So this was probably around 2007, 2008 at that time. Well, they don't charge them in a parking lot at a supermarket. They charge it at their house, right? So everyone with a driveway can charge their car at home, charge it overnight. And if you have a road trip, you might need some sort of station to charge on the way. But that's it. You're not going to go to a supermarket to charge. You're going to go to a specific charging station, just like you would go to a gas station. So this was the flaw that we found in people just like lazily taking all of this government money, is that they are not incentivized to make what people need, which is an affordable charging station. And the other economic thing, which is super crucial that Mario figured out, is that going forward, there's going to be way more people living in apartment complexes and condos. And what that means is that people need to charge there, and there aren't charging stations there. If we make a model that makes a very affordable charging station that's able to be board approved within a meeting, which means a 2-page contract or less,
yeah,
with a network of electrical engineers that can do a verified install for like $1,200, the charging station's $300, not $1 million, we can then start to penetrate early on the electric vehicle charging market in condos and apartments where people are going to come online, and we can go out from beneath all of these expensive whales that are trying to make these like inefficient systems in parking lots.
Yeah.
Because that's where we know the market is moving. And so once we get a lot of EV penetration in the market, we're going to actually be there for that. And then when Tesla comes in, people are going to be able to say, our apartment and condo is Tesla ready, and you can bring your car here, and you're going to get more sales of your apartment and condo because of that. So
it's nice.
Yeah.
So then, like, you maybe just to kind of circle back a little bit on this, did you end up taking Venture for EverCharge?
Yeah. Yeah, we did.
Nice. And EverCharge is still around today, right? I mean, it was started as GoGreen, and now it's EverCharge. So what ended up being like your sort of the peak of that story? Where did you kind of, you know, get to and then decide, oh, I've got to do my next thing?
Yeah. So part of my role is sometimes to be at the beginning of a thing and be an instigator. I'm not always the person that sticks around for the second stage of the rocket. You know, sometimes I just build the launch pad, right? So I think it's important to note that I worked on it pretty heavily during college and into about 2010. Mario really is the genius on that thing. The name was terrible. Go Green It. Evercharge is way better. And he was able to like really understand the business model and wrangle things up. And, you know, he's good technically as well. So what happened was, you know, I got my first, okay. The other thing is that I learned a bunch of stuff in my thesis. And one of the things that I learned in my thesis was, there's this idea of Marshall Berman, all that is solid melts into air. It's like, there's all this like Marxist stuff that I was learning. The idea is that you have physical goods and then you have digital goods. And let's look at how things go from solid, let's just say solid buttons on an interface like a BlackBerry, to liquid buttons that can be anywhere on a screen, to virtual buttons that could be anywhere, basically geofences that you could walk into that have a transition state for you. So my hypothesis was that the next generation of the button was going to be in the air. And that's partially what my thesis was about. I wanted to make that a reality. So I started this startup called GeoLoki, which is kind of Latin for location-based communication. And we were, I think, maybe the very first location platform for iPhone and Android. We actually built it as a platform, and initially, even before iPhone and Android had location-based services and GPS chips on them. And it worked on a Boost Mobile and like a Palm.
Nice. But this is probably pre-Foursquare too, yeah?
Yeah, I think Foursquare... Well, let's see. Yeah, we started this in 2010. So I think Foursquare was like emerging at that time.
Yeah.
So it became very interesting because I was going to these conferences called like Wear Camp, which was like kind of an underground conference aside from O'Reilly's Wear 2.0, which is expensive, the business of location. Wear Camp was like a bunch of hackers and artists coming together being like, geolocation should be free, da, 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 and being really cool, you know? And so out of that, I remember going to a conference in Portland and playing a game by Tennis Crowley and a bunch of people at NYU's ITP called Pac-Manhattan, where you were basically Pac-Man and their coordinators that were remote on phones, and you were running around the city collecting, you know, trying to catch ghosts and, you know, trying to catch each other.
This was like the pre-Pokemon Go era, huh? This, nice.
This was the beginning. This was the geolocative games, right?
Yeah.
It was right, you know, it was Obama era, and the cell phone had come out, and we were using what the cell phone made it possible for. And it wasn't totally a smartphone yet. Only one of us had an iPhone, but the rest of us were just like on these phones, coordinating our location, telling, you know, the intersection markers, and then having our remote puzzle piece updated on a map with a bunch of controllers. It was a total revelation for me. Like, what if your app knew where it was? That was the question that we were answering with GeoLoki. And then, what could it mean for coordination? And so my co-founder, Aaron, had been tracking his location for like the past 5 years at 5 second intervals and mapping them. And we were taking all of his location data, color coding it based on speed, time of day, you know, and putting it onto maps and putting it at art galleries and like giving talks. And one of the talks that we gave afterwards, somebody was like, I want to use this too. When is this a startup? We're like, what? A startup? And so we made just like a little framework, and we raised, for the very first year, we kept our day jobs. Basically, I did 40 hours a week at my day job, 60 hours a week on GeoLoki. We, you know, the server in our closet heated our house. It was the smallest apartment. We had like 10 screens where we could see all the different processes. If the process got too long, rewrote it so it was simpler. We had a map of all the locations with pins. We started to get more and more people. So the very first year, we actually made all of our money for the startup via taking our platform, taking our API to hackathons and stress testing it, having other people build on it. And then if we won the hackathon, we knew we were going in the right direction. So this was just a huge thing that we did. And
well, Amber, one thing I did want to do is, this was, it sounds like your first, you know, for some of the people who are saying stuff about it, like, oh, when is this, when is this a company? When is, oh, geo, you know, geolocation should be open and all that. I think it's a good, way for us to back into like the stuff you're doing in Web3. So I want to make sure we get to Plurigrid. Grid. Yeah. And like we're coming up, you know, with about 25, 30 minutes. I want to make sure we cover the cool shit you guys are doing at Clary Grid. So, but we can't do that without first talking about Dow Dow. So I wanted to get to that real quick. You know, you've had this super interesting background, and, you know, a lot of the, I'd say since Dow Summer happened in like 2020-ish, 2021, depends on who you ask, but, you know, there's a lot of this sort of, I would call it technological solutionism around, you know, programmable institutions and smart contracts. And these are all going to make our social interactions so much more efficient, you know, for who, for what. But so you, given your background in anthropology and, you know, cyborg anthropology as well, I feel like you are one of the most well-positioned folks who is also grounded in this work to kind of give us your perspective on, you know, you're building Dow Dow. What has your experience been like in DAOs, socially, politically, wherever you want to start? I would just love to hear that before you jump into Plurigrid.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'll try to keep this really short. So the term DAO, Decentralized Autonomous Organization, does not come from crypto. It actually comes from a 1997 paper on home automation and cybernetics. And that's the most important thing to remember, is that it's not a Web3 native term. It's about having a system of control in the home that self-regulates and metabolizes. And it's really important to talk a little bit about cybernetics and when we relate them to DAOs, just to set the tone of why most DAOs don't make sense and why technological determinism, just being like, if you just have a tech, it will work, misses the point, right? So the number one thing about self-regulating systems, like two analogies. One, if you use Fahrenheit, 98.6 is what all of the systems in your body combined to self-regulate and keep your body at that temperature, which is incredible. There's a ton of basically autonomous systems running, self-regulating, going to the mean. Sometimes you might get your temperature to like 105. Oh no, you know, that's bad, right? The self-regulation is out. There's something in the system and it can't totally control it and it can't get it back to the luminous mean. And then we have to have external interventions in order to, like, you know, throw into that loop and, you know, it cause a forced quit of some of those things, right? So then another analogy is like an airplane wing. A pilot cannot be sitting there watching the freaking airplane wing and controlling it when there's turbulence. It needs to be a self-regulating system with a ton of partial differential equations that's tested, simulated, run through that loop a ton of times, adding the variables to it, adding extra turbulence, adding extra, you know, protrusions, adding extra pieces. And then the pilot needs to know whether the stabilizers and whether, you know, that is out, and then they can get a light on their dashboard, and then they can call, you know, they can call the control tower. So when we think about the origins of DAOs, it was your house with its thermostat should be able to self-regulate itself, understand when it's too humid, adjust for that, understand when it's too cold, too hot, and get it to that perfect controllable environment, just like your body, but the exoskeleton of it. So that's where it actually came from. Now, when we apply that to DAOs themselves, DAOs how they are today, they're not totally decentralized. They're usually a couple people that know each other. They're not really totally organizations. They're more disorganizations. Definitely. They're not autonomous, because you need a ton of understanding of diplomacy and governance and some bureaucracy or some experience of working in a co-op to be able to do this, you know? So one of the first speeches I gave on this was like 8 ways to hack a DAO without code. You know, all you need to do is throw some FUD in. All you need to do is slow things down. All you need to do is make people feel uncertain. All you need to do is like seed some like arguments between people, and you can crush most DAOs. Also, DAOs are kind of like buttons attached to your wallet. Oh, Constitution DAO. Let's own a piece of the Constitution. We don't know what's going to happen after, and we definitely know and plot out what we're going to do if it fails. So if you don't have ways to simulate or understand this behavior of the system, and you don't include economics, behavioral economics, especially, you know, political science, motivations, understanding of humanity, you cannot make a super good DAO. Basically, what you're doing is making things accidental that have a cool token price at the beginning. It goes off towards the end. And that's why, you know, Michael Zargum's, you know,
block science. Yeah, yep.
Block science is incredible, right? So when I met Michael Zargum and he was explaining to me, you know, his perspective on cybernetics, when I started learning about block science, when I started learning about CAD-CAD, for me, this was just like 3 months ago. It was like the revelation I was looking for. It was, okay, this is actually the thing. You know, cyborg anthropology is cool, but this is the real stuff, because what you're able to do with that is take a DAO, simulate your tokenomics model with with the augmented bonding curve in CAD-CAD. See what it's going to be like over time. You can have like a proof of reserve with your hatch. You can simulate this over time, and then you can see how people are going to interact. And this is amazing, right? Because it's not siloing all these things. You're able to keep it in the simulation model, and you're able to actually figure out how you want your system to go with a ton of iterations before you actually take it out in the real world and hurt people, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a great... We had Jeff Emmett from Block Science here on episode 9 quite a while ago, but basically this... What I'm super interested in, I feel like we covered Dow. Honestly, we might come back to Dow, but I think what's really interesting about this is the fact that since you're working with Zargum's tools, and you know Zargum, you know these guys are booked out like a year in advance. They're simulating and working with so many DAOs and protocols on this type of stuff. What's really interesting to me is that it seems like you have. I've said this to Jeff too, so I'm not picking on him, but like they post a lot of really in-depth Medium articles, and I feel like they leave out the secret sauce of like, can you show me where's the GitHub? I want to run this myself. Like, you know, they put their stuff out there, but you know, they'll probably post a thing with Hedera recently on Guardians, and I was like, well, what does it do in the open, right? And so I feel like you have backed into a really interesting use case for actually using CAD-CAD to simulate real life distributed electrical networks. So I feel like this would be a great time to almost back into what are you doing at PluriGrid?
Sure. Okay, so let's just look at electricity. Electricity is one of the weirdest things ever. You have to use it when you generate it. It's really hard to store. There's electrons, right? There's charges, there's, you know, power lines. But fundamentally, it's almost an invisible resource, the way that we've built up the grid. And you notice it when it breaks. Now it's breaking more and more often. And also we have all of these energy sources at the edge of the grid that are renewable that are causing havoc. Sometimes there's way too much energy available. Sometimes there's not enough. And when you're a centralized grid planner, you sometimes need to say, okay, we're going to get these energy from coal sources when all these people are trying to charge their electric car at 5 p.m. when they get home from work. Oh, no. Like, it, you know, there's all these issues, right?
Our renewable energy plans have been foiled.
Right. So basically, you know, let's think first about like public goods. You know, it's like in economics, a public good is both non-excludable and non-rivalrous. Right. So the idea is that people can't be banned from accessing them or failing to pay for them. Now, there aren't a ton of like real public goods. Right. Like, let's just think about something like streetlights. Like, yes, taxpayer money pays for streetlights. But if you suddenly don't pay your taxes, they're not going to take away the streetlight on your street, right? Like, you know, but you can still use them as education, you know, roads, kind of, you know, I would also count Wikipedia as a public good. You know, not all of us pay for Wikipedia, it's there. And so, you know, if we look at that and we look at, you know, what needs to happen with the grid is that, you know, there are a bunch of distributed energy resource management and distributed energy resources, DERs, that are coming out where they're like, I have solar panels on my roof. I have an electric car that needs charging. I want to make a wind farm. And then there's people in like Kenya or like in the Ukraine where like, we need to bootstrap a grid. Oh my gosh, right? So all at all different scales, everybody's having problems. You know, rolling blackouts aren't necessarily a terrible thing. That's like, you know, they're scheduled, right? It's like, this is a way of dealing with like too much energy or too little energy, you know? But the problem is that coordination is a mess because if we're transitioning from centralized resources to distributed energy resources, the integration, the coordination, bidirectionality as generators, you know, become super crucial. And we need methods for data availability throughout all these grid networks. And we also need assurance mechanisms to faithfully execute scientific planning of new grids or new grid resources that are coming online. And if we do this, we can actually get pretty far in power system decarbonization. Literally, this is like one of the ways to like change the world and get us within these limits, you know, keeping anthropogenic warming, you know, below 1.5 Celsius, right? Like this is, we can do this, right? So,
and just so we don't miss the this, right? We just play it back to you, right? We're talking about building scalable models for management of distributed electrical grid resources as a public good, right? So basically saying that, like, hey, we would, I just came back from COP, right, for example. And at COP, people were talking about, we went to this thing called World Climate Summit, which is a big meeting of public-private partnership people, right? And so they're basically saying, hey, one of the major things we have to do this century in sub-Saharan Africa is, how do we fund distributed energy grid resources, because people are just going to continue cutting down trees and using coal, right? And this is, at the end of the day, when you think about all the global emissions, this isn't that big, right? It's like probably it's single digit percentage point, but it's going to grow, right? And so getting ahead of that, right? Maybe you can speak to, maybe we dig into like a real world use case or something. But when you mentioned we need data availability for these things to be able to make scientific planning decisions, we need a way to provision this stuff and decide and decision ways to make decisions on it. Like, what does that all kind of look like, and what you're building at PluriGrid?
Okay, let's just say I'm an energy stakeholder in Kenya, and I know that my town's going to increase in population growth. And while the average energy consumption per person is less than 1,000 kilowatts hour per year, US national average is about 11,000 kilowatts hour per year, I know that there's going to be a strong population growth, and I need to start planning to sustain increases in electricity demand, right? So let's say I hear about PluriGrid, from a friend in the Kenyan Energy Department, and I go to the website, and at first I find an app, and the app helps me find optimal placement for solar panels to maximize that solar energy generation, and then a simulation of how converting the solar energy into electricity can kind of help to handle the demand curves of the town's predicted energy consumption depending on time of day. Okay, cool. Now, can I use this to put together kind of an estimated ROI for energy production and kind of understand how surplus energy could be traded with other towns in a kind of rebate mechanism collateralized with local currency? If I can do that, then I can see an economic model for us to be able to invest in the grid, because I have the simulation model of an understanding. And then I can understand the full stack of both energy and economic impact that this project can have. And I'm able to raise funding way more quickly, and then be able to easily purchase the right solar panels, inverters, PluriGrid enabled battery hardware to start these microgrids, right? Now, that's like a fairly simple story on somewhere where you don't necessarily have a grid. Here's another story of, we call these people e-gens, right? Anybody who's interested in having these edge resources, right? Like,
but, we got degens, regens, e-gens. We're covering the full spectrum of gens. Awesome. Yeah. Sorry, so continue.
Here's another one, it's like, let's say I'm a Texan and I want to make money selling electricity back to the grid. I have this Inflation Reduction Act initiative to install a battery, on my ranch, right? And so if I download the PluriGrid app, then I get information on the selection of hardware. I need a battery, I need a network aware microinverter, and maybe a smart charger for my phone. And then after I perform this installation and connect the battery to the solar panels, I start uploading, visual inspection photos. And I start receiving, now this is where it gets interesting, get this kind of like local grid token, let's say it's Dallas token, And if I charge my phone using the smart charger that I get extra Dallas tokens to recompensate me from the charging, right? So, I think it's notable to think about like why you would have this like tokens, there's electrons, there's tokens, there's, with smallest available information that you can have. Why this would scale is because you're not just building it with like, we're not building on Ethereum where it's, can you imagine building this on Ethereum where like, oh no, it's like Bored Ape Yacht Club, but for energy, we have too many.
Oh my God.
And now the gas price is crazy. No, the whole point is to build with self-sovereign blockchains, and you have IBC communicating through them, so you can have your own self-sovereign grid.
Oh, so we are backing into Cosmos talk. Yes, fantastic. We are Cosmos. I mean, I at least am a Cosmos stan on the pod. I'm not going to speak for Martin. But yes, continue.
Yeah. So, my introduction to the Cosmos ecosystem was, I like to join things three generations on. I'm an early late adopter or late early adopter. So, I'll get the iPhone 3. I'm not going to pay for the bootstrapping of the supply chain for the iPhone 1 and the slowness. And I've noticed that almost every physical system, let's just say cameras, the first camera comes out, it's got something cool. It's a step change in the industry. It's the, you know, it's a mirrorless camera by Sony, right? Wow. Like now you have a smaller thing. Great. I'm not going to buy that one. The A7 II is going to have all the features you want, but the battery life is total crap, right? And then the third generation is going to have all the stuff you need, plus the battery life is good, right? So that third generation model is where I'm always jumping in on, right? I mean, I have these little cones, like jump on the third model, whatever. But so when I was thinking about, you know, Bitcoin and then like Ethereum, I saw Cosmos as the third gen. I said, okay, now the issues that we saw with Bitcoin's the, you know, the divine birth of Bitcoin. You know, I read the white paper in 2009, yeah. Right? Like, I was like, wow. But then also, like, I was doing a startup, you know, I was waiting. And then there's, you know, Ethereum, which had the gas fees, and I just call it battery life issues, right? Like, you know, it's just expensive, and it's not interoperable. So when my friend introduced me to Cosmos and IBC, because I was looking at Polkadot, I was just trying to find anything that was interoperable. Being able to make your own sovereign chain and communicate between those systems reminded me of ARPANET. So my grandpa worked on ARPANET. He worked on the fourth node of ARPANET that connected the East Coast to the West Coast, like kind of like Golden Spike in the railroad, you know? And what that meant was that in ARPANET, so the NSFNet and then ARPANET, you have all these computers, PDP-8s and PDP-11s, that are written weird because everybody's making their own thing and they can't communicate. So TCP/IP allowed everything to connect, and it allowed for the proliferation of all things. So if we make a neutral protocol that anybody can use and build on top of that allows connections at scale to all of these systems and allow for sovereign blockchains, people to be able to run their own resources in this way, we have something for energy that's like TCP/IP. It's super important that it's open. It's super important that it's a public good. The internet could not have been placed in the place that it is without a neutral protocol like that. You know, it's also the same with like POP, IMAP, SMTP for email. You can run any client. Yeah. How do you monetize the protocol? Like, there's so many things you can build on top. There's entire companies that are built on top of these systems that are, you know, billion dollar companies, right? So most importantly is to say, you know, and I always like to do this, like what's, you know, the least amount of thing you can build to enable the proliferation of many things, right? Like how many Darwin inches can you get out of the system so that people can do this, you know? And so that's really important because, you know, if you can do that, that's great, but it can't be done just that way, right? Because with DAOs, with tokenomics, you know, with like people just randomly installing this on things without coordination strategies, without incentive models, without those being tested, we're going to have people hurt, right? Transactive energy model, like we know the story of all the history of this, right? People get hurt if you don't.
Exactly. And everyone has made their own version of a dystopian sci-fi flick about this. In addition, we didn't even need them to do that, right? The real world has already provided some terrible examples.
Right. So the main difference, one of the main differences with Plurigrid is, let's just look at a little history here. How do you design an electrical circuit? How do you design a chip? You simulate it first, you know, use a thing called SPICE from 1973. First, we understand that electricity is fundamentally dangerous and it can kill people. We also understand that tokenomics models are dangerous and can drain people. We understand that everything that we're doing as technologists is dangerous and we need to be ethical about it. And the best way to do it is to look at, you know, what did the Wright brothers do that was better than other people? They had a kind of simulation test harness framework so they could run their planes through really, really fast and course correct a feedback loop, a cybernetic feedback loop in a way to make adjustments without risking the lives of people every time they flew the plane through. How did that turn out for them? It was great, right? So why, when we're dealing with inherently dangerous things, would we not simulate them first? That's ridiculous. So
this is a big commercial for Michael Zockerman, Block Science.
Yeah. So, you know, look at this model thing called SPICE, right? So SPICE is really interesting. The SPICE simulation model from 1973, it's a text description of a circuit component used by the SPICE simulator to mathematically predict the behavior of that part under varying conditions. So this is super important because you could do that with electricity. And that's ethical to simulate it first, right? That's ethics. But how do you add in components to this? How do you add in more variables? Because if everybody's using this as electrical engineers, and this is what you use, and it's really solid and nice, why don't you do that for tokens? You know? Well, there's a thing called Token Spice. And Token Spice simulates tokenized ecosystems via agent-based approaches. It's, you know, it's EVM, right? Okay, cool. This can help with token engineering flows to design and tune and verify tokenized ecosystems. So Token Spice just simulates by running a loop. At each iteration, the agent in the netlist takes a step, and netlist wires up a collection of agents to interact in a given way. Each agent is a class, has an Ethereum wallet, does work to earn money. Agents may be written pure Python or an EVM-based backend. So you could model a system by just writing a netlist, tracking metrics, KPIs, and you could write your own netlist and agents to simulate whatever you like. Okay, great. Take this two steps further, right? So if we're going to use this for Plurigrid, you need to be able to simulate, you need to be able to add more variables. You need to be able to simulate Token Spice with sovereign blockchains, simulate when you need to have your own sovereign blockchain so that you don't experience like network congestion, simulate IBC works to connect the systems, and then add capacities for even more simulation on the governance level, on the policy level. So you could simulate not just the electrical grid, which is necessary, but the tokenomics and all these policy pieces so that you can show in a safe way initially, and that's, you know, that's what the initial funding is for, to make the simulation model. You can show that anyone can bootstrap their grid, that there's a reasonable, sustainable public goods funding model for that, that there's pluralistic funding models like augmented bonding curve, which allows for a hatch period, a way to have a provable reserve, so we don't have an FTX scenario for all of these things, and a way to model out the tokenomics that can result in sustainable, longer term and healthy microeconomies so that the end user opens up the system, figures out how to add their stuff to the grid, how to coordinate with each other, how to choose what kind of electricity that they want, and to disintermediate all of the middle layer aggregators and allow people to seize the means of coordination. Now, in that, you can also model incentive models, right? So,
One second before you get too deep on that, because this is fascinating. But I wanted to step back because you and your team and the folks, you know, Barton and other folks who are working in Plurigrid, you know, this idea of modeling like infrastructure planning and energy usage is not a new one, right? Like you said, you don't want to be the first one, right? You'd like to be the third one or something, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like, you know, NREL has, the scalable integrated SIP, the scalable integrated infrastructure planning framework. There's a number of these open source that have been put out there. Why did you folks decide to build your own? What are the existing solutions what made you go, hey, we got to do something about this and we got to do it this way?
Yeah. Well, personally, I wrote this fairly influential book called Calm Technology, and I kept using energy analogies in it in all of my speeches. And then I said, I got to work on electricity. And I was thinking about this like for a couple of years before I met Barton, and Barton's like, grid. I was like, okay, oh yeah, this is great. So, you know, another thing is like, there are people like Enode, it's a Norwegian startup that allows all these energy apps to connect to all of the different smart home items, you know, like especially with inverters, like you have solar panels, batteries, smart energy hardware, all through a single API. Hooray! We don't have to do that work, right? You can partner with somebody like that, but there's still a centralized resource, right? And so if we look at, you know, some of the things that people are working on, you know, NREL collaborated with Holy Cross Energy, and they did this Holy Cross Energy partnership where they started to build out a home that also functions as a microgrid. There's the Brooklyn microgrid, you know, they have community power energy as an energy marketplace for locally generated solar energy. We see people trying the beginnings of this, and where they get stuck is, first off, some people are simulating things. The simulations are only working in certain countries. You're not having a simulation that includes the tokenomics model that allows you to be like, hey, government, or hey, small group of people, you can fundraise at the local level and actually build out this grid, and you're going to be able to see in the future how that's going to make you money and how it's going to be resilient and self-sustaining. People need that in order to invest. Now, you know, one of the things that's, you know, I kind of bring to this is geocommunication company got acquired by Esri. So Esri is a huge GIS company. It's a geographic information systems. And one of the things that they do is they have these models where you can simulate urban planning, right? So one of my favorite projects that they did was in Honolulu, they did this thing called City Engine. So City Engine is like one of the Esri product offerings. You do a procedural map of a city based on the code of the city, and you can do a side-by-side comparison map. So you could say, if we invest X amount in public infrastructure like transit system, and or we just leave it to suburban sprawl, what are going to be the costs in the future in terms of road, in terms of like housing structure, in terms of crime, you know? And you can do a compare and contrast. You can take that to the planning department and say, actually, if we invest $40 million in a public transit system, it's going to remove $80 million worth of maintenance costs, crime, and all that stuff.
Wow.
Power of simulation, right? So if we do it this way versus all of these like little ad hoc models, it's like, it's great that, you know, it has this API. That's awesome. That's part of the piece. We don't want to have to do that piece. Oh my gosh. We want to be able to partner with all of these producers of these products. But if we can have a simulation model that proves out, then you can actually do this reasonably and be able to study the incentive models and do small pilot projects where we're testing one of the 93, you know, coordination models and incentive models, you know, tokenomics, all these things in a safe environment. We can run through those super fast, learn super, super quickly, and then we can apply those out and do pilot programs, and then we can scale, right? So in terms of the traction gap, it's like, you know, go to scale product happens, you know, after we build this test, we, you know, with our initial funding, and then we take that and we scale that, right? That you can say, this is provable, you know, it's just so much of a disaster. Like if you're doing this piecemeal and you don't have this understanding, what are you doing? It's just like, we've had at least 1973 simulation models.
Yeah.
We have digital twins. I used to do consulting for PTC, which is like one of the leaders in digital twin companies. You know, the other really cool thing you can do if you have this kind of digital twin model is within your kind of virtual power plant, you can understand when somebody's battery is not performing as well and to tell them to replace it. You can understand the demands on the market that are going to happen, you know, 2 days in advance, 4 weeks in advance. You start to have an incredible pool of data that's more than you can get as a centralized planning node at a global scale.
You now backed into that. Actually, this is a great spot to then ask you, you know, for, you mentioned bootstrapping open source distributed energy grids, microgrids. What is becomes the business model for this, right? Because if you're providing this a flurry grid, you're providing, you know, library, a token economics model, something that anyone can come in and build on locally. How does value accrue to the network and to the folks who are coming in to invest? Because the other thing is too, is that like you definitely, this is the thing I've talked to Scott Moore about a lot, who Scott Moore has basically, you know, he's, you know, public goods are good, et cetera. That's his whole brand. But this is a thing that's on the top of his mind too. Like, how do we sustainably fund public goods and how do we make public goods also return? So in this specific instance, what are you folks thinking?
Yeah. Okay. So the way I think about it is I look at business models a couple different ways. I like to do an analysis and take my time. I don't think it's worth going into something without, you know, and also like just thinking about EverCharge, it took us a while to find a really great scalable business model, and it's worth taking the time to do it on the beginning, you know? So I look at it like, first I see what's out there, knowing that that might not be the final model, right? With Anode, utilities pay for access to aggregated storage capacity available on the React network using its tokens, and then the proceeds of that sale are split between Anode Labs and the battery owner. Okay, cool. With EverCharge, it's like, you know, you pay for this model and then there's a monthly cost. Okay, cool. With, you know, with Plurigrid, because we have simulation technology, it's way more interesting because you can also simulate business models through the tokenomics models, right? So you could show, for instance, like, you know, this tokenomics model that deliver, like, let's say we make grid token, right? And then anybody who uses the Plurigrid protocol gives back to that grid token, increasing its market cap. Right? Like that's probably the simplest business model. It's just like, there's a percentage of the company. That's like the network fee, right? The other thing is like, when you keep simulating, you simulate business models in the loop, you could come up with a proliferation of business models. And also it's kind of like, sometimes business models are emergent. Like, I don't want to say, here is the final business model. That's ridiculous.
Of course. Yeah. This is definitely
the ability for the system to find the best business model, right?
It's absolutely.
Like, if water goes to the lowest point, like, you don't want to say, like, you don't want to, like, you have to work kind of with gravity here. And so it's really important to, yeah, to allow that to be emergent. And then I just, one of my favorite books is called Founders at Work. If you haven't read it, everybody should read this book. It's by Jessica Livingston, who's partnered with Paul Graham. But I love the story about PayPal. I think PayPal was initially made that you could, on a Palm Pilot, send money to each other, you know, in like 2000 or whatever. And when eBay came along and started using PayPal, they were like, oh, look at all these random people using this thing. This is so, like, don't judge people for using your system. That became a huge business model, right? So the point is to create the conditions for an interesting and sustainable business model to emerge that doesn't have to be predetermined. And in that emergence, you end up having something that, like, can be a new model, you know, can be a step change. And sometimes that takes a while, right? Especially with a protocol. But there's plenty of ways to capture value on the way. Like, there could be, but it's important to kind of look at what people are doing and then, yeah, simulate that out. The best thing to do is obviously make a sustainable tokenomics model that anybody can participate in, run it enough, run the incentive models enough so that you know when somebody, you know, puts in a specific country or they put it in their backyard, they're going to be able to have sustainable energy for their devices and be able to liquidate that in a way that doesn't, like, cost the network a lot of money. All of those little safety mechanisms. And then if you can do that, and you have a bunch of eGens who are super excited and they start to use it for their own weird uses, things start to emerge out of that that you couldn't expect that are the next generation of transactive energy. And that's the powerful stuff, right?
And I think, like, you know, going in, like, a thing that I'm looking at very closely too is the fact that, like, we did kind of dump on Bitcoin, but Bitcoin as an energy purchaser of a last resort to drive the adoption of renewable energy and microgrids is a super interesting idea. But at the same time, it's an interesting idea that requires an open source framework for provisioning and decision points around, do we use this energy to mine more Bitcoin? Do we store it or do we release it for local use, right? And if someone is out there sitting, you know, trying to say, hey, I want to use hydro, or I want to use solar, or I want to use, you know, what have you, wind in and mine green Bitcoin, but also use it to drive the adoption of more of solar, maybe in a microgrid, they should focus on doing that and not building the energy resource management under the hood. That's kind of the implication, yeah?
Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe a last thing to say about this, you know, before we wrap up is you want people to be able to choose what energy they want. And if you don't want people to vote on that, you can delegate it to, you know, your sort of political alignment. Let's say I want, you know, just hydropower. I should be able to choose that. Let's say I want, you know, the solar. I should be able to choose that. And if I'm setting up my grid, I should be able to choose what configuration and have a lot of that done for me so that I'm not sitting there in the weeds with my partial differential equations. Like, it's just really important to, you know, have the stuff behind the scenes that we know is complex and then have to the end user the ability to quickly bootstrap these things and understand what they're getting into. And so, yeah, it's a super interesting space. It's a super interesting puzzle to work on. And yeah, you know, this sort of thing is necessary. Somebody's going to build it eventually, you know, but I think we got to work on it. It's just, I think when I see people make startups, they're like, I'm making the next Facebook. I'm like, there's no next Facebook, you know, you're going to get acqui-hired by some company for doing some, you know, bad form of a thing, or just like looking at people trying to use Mastodon when it's like definitely not made for that scale.
Yeah.
People aren't thinking big enough. People aren't thinking global scale. People aren't thinking at the protocol level. Last time I met somebody who was thinking at the protocol level was when I went and met Juan Benet in like 2014 or whatever. And mm-hmm. You know, he came to our hackerspace in Portland, Oregon. And I was like, wow, somebody actually cares. And he is so good at explaining, you know, global scale stuff. And he's so galaxy brained. And I remember meeting him being like, actually, this guy might be able to pull this off. I was so thrilled, you know?
Yeah.
And when you meet people like that, you just, there aren't that many people that are even okay at thinking that big because everybody is so chained to the present moment and what exists that they don't have room to see what's possible. And the amount of change that we're going to be dealing with, you know, everyone's always like, what happens in 2030? I'm like, do you even understand how different things can be to decade?
Yes, absolutely.
Stuff right now, you know, you're not going to exist. Like, it's just a totally different model. So getting ahead of this stuff while also being behind is really important. To just even look at this is enough to get people excited to be able to change things. So,
I can tell you for sure that coming back from some of the conferences where the world's biggest energy and capital allocators are sitting there thinking about the necessity of microgrids for decarbonization, the money is at least there, but I'll tell you, they do not have the bottom-up perspective that's necessary to integrate the two views, right? And I think that's one of the things that both the approaches you folks are taking, in addition to modeling tokenomics, can maybe fill the gap in, right? So super interesting stuff, Amber. I was just going to say, just, you know, since we're wrapping up around kind of the last bit here, where can folks follow your work online and stay in touch with Plurigrid and everything you're working on?
Sure. Well, you can go to plurigrid.xyz. Again, we're building things behind the scenes, so it's not like everything. It's like you could follow me online, you know, twitter.com/caseorganic or caseorganic.com, or I have, you know, an old outdated Medium blog that has a bunch of information about like the history of the web and TCP/IP, but it's not super updated right now because it's like when you're building, you just can't take care of that stuff really well. But yeah, you know, I'm on Twitter, I'm around, and, you know, it'd be fun to meet in person at some cool place. I'm literally just, you know, hanging out and reading a bunch of research papers and just trying to consolidate all this information in my brain so that I can communicate it better, so that we can, you know, move forward as a species, whatever. So yeah, Twitter's probably the best. And then you can also look up, you know, probably my most well-known work is in Calm Technology. And you can also look at calmtech.com and read some really cool papers from Xerox PARC about ethics and technology, came out in the 90s, that definitely have to do with, you know, how we're dealing with electricity today.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for that rundown and for the story. I feel like we went on an adventure through the origin of the internet, cybernetics, and, you know, a whole bunch of things out to now, like, the future of the energy grid. So this is awesome.
Yeah, thanks. It's so nice to finally be on this podcast. I kind of wanted to wait until there's something really big to talk about. So, yeah. My girl gave me a bowl cutter.